All right, so we're still in Chapter 3 of Sepp Holzer's Permaculture. I've got Alex Hojeda on the phone with me, and I think we're going to finish Chapter 3 today.
All right.
This is about fruit varieties, so he's got a lot to say about varieties, like which varieties work better than others, and then also about some varieties that he has gotten to do well on his land, which he was told would not do well. And then he goes into propagation of fruit trees and grafting. And there are some things in there that are a little different than the standard, but for the most part, it's kind of like there is, you know, he talks, the things he talks about are his way of grafting and whatnot are kind of like a way that's rather traditional, although he's got a few spins of his own on it. And then creating the fruit forest, his interesting transplanting technique for trees that he refers to as the shock method, which I think is really fascinating.
That's awesome.
And then finally, there's a piece at the very end of this chapter that has to do with farming that I think is really awesome. And I can't. That's gonna be my favorite part of this. But for me, when I marked up this chapter, I don't know about you, Alex, but when I marked up this chapter, it's like again I was kind of thinking that I was marking up too much, but then when it came to all the grafting parts, I didn't mark up hardly at all. So it all worked out in the end.
Right. Well, with me, because grafting isn't part of my world yet. I'm still building soils and putting in infrastructure and stuff like that. So the whole grafting thing, I know it's there and I hear cool things about it. But hearing Sepp Holzer's take on grafting, he kind of shows you where the world is on grafting and then he points out what he does differently. And to me, that's like magic from the ancient wizard. You know, I absolutely want to hear that, you know. And it just sort of it makes you feel like you can grow anything anywhere on any tree. Well, you know, any compatible tree, which is super cool. But yeah, I took a couple of notes on the specifics that I think is specific to him.
You know, I get a lot of people asking me about where to go to take a PDC, like what's the best place for a PDC. And I think that if people are going to sign up for the world of grafting and whatnot and propagation, I would say that the best place would probably be the Bullock Brothers Farm out on Orcas Island in Washington State. Nursery stuff is like their bread and butter there. And they've got all these different techniques, and you go out there and visit with them, and even if you're doing something else, it seems like their ongoing conversations are always about different species, different varieties, different kinds of grafting, what you can graft onto something else, things of that nature.
Right.
This is like really their core thing. That said, I think that there's a lot of this stuff that I'm not all that keen on. As far as grafting, I'm more of a like, let's grow the whole tree from seed, and then it's like you're going to end up with something that's not going to be true to parent, and it might even be a chance that it's like, you know, you're going to spit it out. I kind of think like there's a lot to be said for the pigs and the chickens and the cattle and whatnot going around and finding these apples, and they're going to enjoy them even if we don't. So there's that, and then on top of it, as we go into our own little forest, our own little food forest, and we go and gather our apples, if they came from seed, a lot of those are going to be like just perfectly awesome apples for us, or even really exceptionally excellent apples. The odds of any of them turning out to be something that would be something you want to get Scion wood off of to be a competitor in the world of apples at the grocery store is very low. But you know, one of the big things that they try to do, well, anyway, a lot of the properties that they try to have for those apples at the grocery store are not necessarily properties that we want in our apples.
Right.
And this kind of comes back to the whole thing of like, oh, it keeps a long time. And it's kind of like, well, the reason why it keeps a long time is that bacteria looks at it and says, that's not food.
Yeah.
That's like a round piece of wood.
I look at what I'm doing is not like I hate grocery stores, but it's sort of I don't know. I'm trying to do something where I don't use a grocery store, so that I'm growing things that allow me to go right out into my garden and pick not the whole plant. You know, like a lettuce plant, you never have to uproot a lettuce plant or cut the whole head off, not unless you have some other reason. But if you're just eating out of your garden, just pull a few leaves off and let that thing live, you know. And so my point is anything that I can go out and just grab and it's good right then and there, fantastic. And everything in the grocery store is grown specifically for its production value, for can I get it to the store and sell it to you? And it's really kind of pitiful.
Right. I think that there's a lot to be said for, like, what are going to be your income streams, but there's also a lot to be said for, like, I think one of the best possible income streams for a permaculture farm is the whole idea of, look, I've grown all this food, and it's really, really good, and you can come and hang out at my house and pay me far too much money to hang out at my house, and you can nibble on my stuff. And I think that the amount of money per pound you get for food that way is going to be vastly more than if you were to try and take it to the Saturday market or something like that.
Right.
So, all right, let's cruise through this chapter. Fruit varieties is on page 115, which is where we're going to start today's podcast. From my experiments, I have discovered that supposedly very demanding varieties, which, according to the experts, only thrive in warm climates and at low altitudes, can also adjust to high altitudes and give satisfactory yields. You should, therefore, not let yourself be dissuaded from cultivating so-called demanding varieties at high altitudes. Naturally, they must be sheltered from the wind, and it's important that they grow in climatically advantageous locations, microclimates, which reflect heat from the sun using stones or bodies of water, for example, and protect the plants from weather extremes by using the effect of structures like hollows or windbreaks, are necessary for this. Under no circumstances should you turn to chemical fertilizers, because this will put the tree out of balance and it will not survive the winter. Fertilized trees grow faster and do not lignify as well as unfertilized ones. This means that they are not as frost resistant. Okay, so I think that this is one of the components so that you can get citrus to grow up in the Alps in Austria.
Right.
So now, of course, for you, you're like, I'd grow citrus in my front yard without doing anything weird.
Yeah, maybe. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, you know, people in your area, if they have half a care with planting citrus and growing citrus, they can oftentimes get a citrus tree to grow just fine, and they don't even think about it, let alone know anything about permaculture.
Right. Well, like, look at I'm in zone 8B or 9. It depends on what map you're looking at, and sometimes they consider it all the same thing. But people consider this area too cold to grow citrus, and then I see what Sepp's doing, and I just have to laugh. You know, there's obviously something that we're doing wrong when we cultivate these things and sell them out of a nursery. Because, I mean, he's growing them from seed. So the message I take back from this chapter, from this whole section here, is you grow things from seed and you don't baby this plant, and it will do amazingly almost anywhere. I mean, you know, you do a few things to, you know, obviously microclimates and things like that to help it out. But you can grow plants that are able to put up with all kinds of things.
Right, so so you got on the one side. I like the last podcast where we did, where you talked about put the tree through boot camp.
Yeah, right.
You know, and so it's like when you use the chemical fertilizers, it's like, okay, feed your tree ice cream and let it play video games all day.
Oh, yeah, that's my idea. Is you got the tree sitting in a recliner, he's playing video games, you're feeding it, and then it basically you walk away and it dies so quickly.
Yeah, and the winter comes along and it's like irk. It's out of here.
Yeah.
And then you've got the one that you've put through the survival camps and boot camp and stuff like that, and it's like, and then winter comes, and it's like, I make winter my bitch!
Yeah, give me some more! Is that all you got? Hoorah! So, you know, but honestly, it's a great anthropomorphic look at human beings and trees, because look at what we're doing to ourselves. You know, that's my point. So whatever you would do,
don't go too far with that. I mean, I enjoy a lot of pie.
You know, a tree might like some kind of a pie too every now and again. But hey, it's usually brought by a bird.
There you go. There yeah, you go.
That's right.
The passing bird or deer syndrome. Mm-hmm. The little pellets of deliciousness, according to a tree. Okay. The chapter then goes into this whole thing. So I think that this is really important. This part that I just read is so good, and then he's got a lot more to say along these lines. But the key is don't use the fertilizers and then trees that are seem to be only for other areas can do very well in your area with a little bit of thought and putting it through that little bit of boot camp. Then he goes into a variety of lists of varieties. He's got varieties for apple trees. He's got varieties for pear trees. And these are the varieties that he likes. And he lists out why he likes these varieties and why he uses these varieties. And it's a lovely list. I haven't highlighted anything out of the list. I don't know if you did.
No.
But he's got apples. He's got pears. He's got cherries. He's got apricots and peaches. I think that the thing is that when I look at this list, I kind of think this looks like a subset of the list that's out at St. Lawrence Nurseries, and that's where I was buying all of my apple trees when I bought apple trees ages ago. The list there was like, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred species of apples. And I think that there's a lot to be said for these kinds of lists, so you can get an idea of like what are the kinds of species that you want, what are the kinds that you might care about. I think it's good to start getting this kind of, well, maybe get an understanding of why you have different species. I mean, you're gonna do some for fresh eating, but I think, you know, some are going to be keepers, winter keepers, and this is something that I didn't see on his list was the whole idea of winter keeper. I think I like the idea of raising a bunch of different trees with the idea of like I want to repropagate and encourage the winter keepers, because the winter keepers make good winter feed for the animals. And one of the ways of doing that is that the fruit that's way up high on the tree in an area where things are kind of steep and I couldn't get to it and I didn't bother will eventually fall off in the middle of winter. And once it lands on the ground, it'll still keep for quite a while. And then when you do your paddock shift systems, even in the wintertime, the pigs and the chickens and whatever else will come through and find those and eat those. And so then they'll sit there and wait until your livestock comes around to get it. So, he's got all these lists.
Well, at the top of the pear list, if I can break in here, he has this one little nugget of Sepulzer genius, and he's basically saying, as a rule, pears should not be harvested late because they have a tendency to become quickly become overripe, and they cannot be stored anymore. It is important to determine the right time to harvest. So he is pointing out that if you're going to have things that that you're going to store away and or use later, you need to figure out when to pick them so that they last longer, which is sort of the grocery store thing, I believe. You know, when you pick up, so you can get it on a truck and it'll last a certain distance. But right. I found it very, very interesting because, you know, I don't know much about fruit trees yet.
Right, right. Okay.
Now, didn't he mention before all this something about the fact that his flavors are so amazing way up there at 1,400 feet and then people buy his stuff specifically because of the flavors?
Right, the much stronger flavors. Yeah.
And I find that very interesting because locally there's a Dr. Wise. He has a naturopath that's out here. He's a pharmacist that also prescribes stuff. Anyway, they're from Germany. His father came over here and taught him all this stuff, more or less, and then he obviously became a doctor. But one of the things that they used to do is they would go way up into the mountains above where most things grow, and he would pick berries and leaves and bark, and he would come down and make this antioxidant-rich tea that would heal the heck out of people. And their whole point was that way up there in those inclement areas, the plants that grow, that are sturdy, that are tough, store away and pack in all the nutrients and all this amazing medicine. It's just their survival. And so when you go up and pick that, it gives you more nutrition. So I'm wondering if, you know, because flavor and produce usually equals nutrition.
Right.
And so I'm wondering if this is what's happening. Like, in other words, if I grow all these great things down here, I'm in a place where it doesn't have to work too hard. So maybe I'm never going to get that amazing flavor that he would up in the mountains. I don't know. What do you think?
I think that there is indeed a lot of truth to that. I think that when you get up into the you get up to higher elevation, you have less oxygen, you have less atmosphere, you have harsher conditions, and I do think, I mean, so we talked about some science fiction last time. I'm sure you're familiar with the series, the Dune series.
Oh yeah, I love Dune.
Yeah, and so I've read that book a couple of times, but the key is that what made these guys such great warriors and whatnot was because the conditions that they grew up in were so harsh.
Right.
And so therefore, because it was so very, very harsh, then they were really tough. And I think there's a lot to be said for the same for plants. If that plant has been able to reproduce there for hundreds of years, way, way up high, then it's gotten to the point that it's a variety that is very, very tough, and it makes the best out of the materials that it's able to gather, and it grows much slower. So I think that yeah, there's a lot to be said for that, and now you're starting to kind of touch into a lot of the reasons why I'm so focused on getting land in the Missoula area.
Right.
I mean, you know, which is very similar to Sepp's land. I mean, there's a bunch of other things. There's a bunch of other criteria why I want to do it here and not. I mean, I get it's probably I've been asked that question probably 300 times now. Why not something that's more in the Puget Sound area? Or something that's down in California, or something in Hawaii, you know.
Think about it. If you could buy land and do something like Sepp's doing, and you had that here, the world could use more parameter hops, you know.
That's true. And Sepp said something to me once about how he wanted me to create a parameter hop in the United States. And so he and I talked about that a little bit, and it's kind of like, geez, but you're right. I mean, I really do think that if you had a parameter hop in the United States, that there'd be, and this is where I kind of think the biggest money in permaculture would be, is the idea of like, okay, you know, have something where at some point in time you're saying, because like right now people will pay big money to go to Sepp's land and stay at one of his little cabins there.
Right.
And so it's kind of like, and why would they do that? I mean, if somebody's like really, really sick, they can come and they can stay on the land. And in theory, one possible thing, try it out. They're eating the food from the land. They're drinking the water from the land. And this is all so much cleaner.
Right.
By such stricter standards. And there's so much more to it. Like there's even a kind of like a feng shui of soil going on.
Right.
That it's like, okay, now you're eating food from the feng shui of soil. And did your problem go away? And if your problem did go away, then it does seem like there's something about the stuff that you're putting through your pie hole that's messing you up, dude.
Right.
And so I think that there's a great deal of value in that, and I don't know of any place in the United States that's anything like that right now.
Right. I've never been to the Bullitt Brothers place, but it sounds like it's probably the closest, maybe?
Well, in the Pacific Northwest, they are the premier permaculture farm in the Pacific Northwest. And then there's Brian Kirkbliet's farm. But I mean, like, both of those, in my opinion, have a ways to go to get close to the Parameter Hof.
Right.
And now, I haven't been to the Bullock Brothers farm for a couple of years now. And I've recently seen some pictures of some things that they've done there that are, like, way ahead of what I saw when I was last there. So I'm kind of thinking I'd really like to go by there this summer and check it out. And maybe things have gotten way better. I need to re-explore that and whatnot. So, but getting back to our book here.
Right.
all right, so we covered the varieties a little bit. I mean, I think the thing is like, you know, buy the book to be able to see the list of varieties. I mean, it talks about the locations, like where's a good place to plant these different varieties. How many varieties has he got here for apples? I think he's got like 30 varieties for apples, and then 15 varieties for pears, and then 6 for plum, 7 for cherries, and 2 for apricot and peach. So it's probably 1 apricot and 1 peach. But and then he talks about, like, you know, what kind of soil is best for them, when they ripen, and then, you know, what the fruit is like.
Mm-hmm.
Because some fruits serve different purposes than others.
It's real interesting to read that, too, because you see all the different things that are going on in, you know, in the different varieties. It's very nice. I just assumed myself that I would have to go redo this list for my area because I'm so drastically different.
Right. Oh, yeah. You're going to benefit more from, like, whatever Fukuoka has to say on the topic, which, by the way, I've heard that somebody is taking another one of Fukuoka's books that's all in Japanese and going through the official and proper channels to get it translated to English.
That would be amazing.
And it should be available soon. And there's another book that's all in Japanese that Helen Attow showed me, and I got to do is see the pictures of it. And Helen was trying to find out from somebody, like, what does this say? You know, what are they saying? Because, you know, she doesn't read Japanese. I don't read Japanese.
Right.
But it seems like that would be another one that would be cool to get, you know, officially, properly translated into English and, you know, get more of that information. But it seems like, basically, Fukuoka and Holzer, very different climates, just as you and I are in very different climates. So the climate I'm in right now is very aligned with Holzer's climate, and the climate you're in is very aligned with Fukuoka's climate. They still came to a lot of the same conclusions, but yeah, when it comes to species, then it seems like, yeah, mm-hmm. you would want to probably look more at, like, Fukuoka's world. And frankly, when it gets to that that kind of climate, the tropical, subtropical kind of stuff, I'm clueless. I have no idea. Can you grow pineapple in your yard?
That's the theory. I haven't put a lot of brain power on the pineapple yet. I've basically stuck a few out here and watched them die. But some people in the area actually have pineapples growing, so I know it can be done. Yeah. You basically chop the top off and stick it in the ground. I mean, I can stick celery stalks in the ground. I've got 2 growing. They just, you know, you eat the celery and stick the base in, and it grows, and there it is, a celery. And same thing with carrots. We've got carrots growing that way. So as I eat my produce, I replant my produce, and then it's like I'm eating it and getting a plant back. You know, it's really nice.
Wow. Yeah, so I don't know. I think that I don't like traveling very much because I'm a giant guy, and giant guys in airplanes is not a good mix typically. But I love pineapple. I really enjoy it, and I've heard that if you go to Hawaii, that the pineapple is even better.
Wow. Well,
and
fresher.
And it's like, yeah, because of the fresher factor.
Yeah.
And I just kind of like, and whenever I hear about Hawaii, I keep thinking about, like, it's so commercial and it's, you know,
it's GMO land now.
Yeah, and I hear about, like, the pineapple fields for conventional pineapple, they smell so horrible because a pineapple doesn't absorb much in the way of the chemicals, like the pesticides don't end up in the pineapple as much.
Oh, that's a good thought.
So, well, yeah, but the flip side is, so then what they do is they actually use more.
Oh, jeez, yeah, of course.
It's like, apparently you go by these fields and it's like, it just smells like a chemical wasteland.
It's a nightmare.
And this is where they're growing the pineapple. And so it's like, I guess you end up with the same level of pesticides in the food because pineapple doesn't take it up as much and they use more. So,
well, we are,
but they do have organic pineapple operations.
Yeah.
And I remember working, years ago, and there was a guy there who was from Hawaii, and he says, what you do is you get on a horse and you ride the horse through the pineapple field, and then the horse will find the best pineapple in the field. And when the horse, you know, starts to chomp at it, then you pull the horse back, and then that's your pineapple, and then let the horse get the next one.
Poor horse, I tell you what.
Yeah.
Doing all the work, getting second rate.
But apparently they pick out the very best pineapple, and I'm kind of thinking, ooh.
Yeah, now you need a horse. Now all of a sudden horses make sense on a farm.
For the first time ever.
Well,
yeah.
You know, I consider them an awesome thing, especially if you're trying to do the whole, you know, Iron Age / 1600s-esque, you know, farming business. You know, no petrochemical kind of thing.
Well, okay, right. I recently recorded a podcast, so you don't know about this, but the pod people that are listening right now do know this, and that is that I recently recorded a podcast with Steve Heckeroth. on electric tractors.
Oh, I heard you talking about it. Yeah.
He's a huge fan of solar, and it's like I hope to record another podcast with him. I think tomorrow I've got it set up, or maybe Tuesday.
Right.
Well, anyway, sometime soon I'm doing another one with him before I head up to all the PDCs and SEP stuff and everything. All right, let's move along with this chapter. propagating and grafting. Now, this whole section, I've kind of skipped over because it's like, man, I'm already really, you know, a lot of this stuff is like your typical standard information about propagation and grafting, and I kind of feel like the book, this will be the low point in the book, not because, I mean, the information is good for that kind of thing, and it's not completely my style, although I do see a place even for me for some of this grafting style. But it's like this is a lot of this is common information, whereas the rest of the book is very rich in how Holzer permaculture deviates from standard gardening or standard agriculture. And so this is kind of like a holdback to more conventional ways of doing stuff. So it's kind of like, you know, it's like you get this amazing stuff, and it's like, you know, pegging out at 10 of like stuff I've never heard before, and is like, you know, so profound and so amazing. And then it's like, you know, now we're going to talk about hot dogs, and like, I like putting mustard on my hot dog, and it's kind of like, yeah, putting mustard on hot dogs, that's one way of doing it.
Right.
That's I've done that before myself, and so then it kind of seems to be this rather banal section. Although I have tried to mark out the parts that I thought were like the different parts, the parts that were like above and beyond out of the banal here.
Right.
But now, my impression is that for you,
yes,
this is not banal. This is not like old hat.
I've never
this
done is... grafting, although I've been through books where they're talking about grafting, and I look at it and I go, okay, great. You get that, you know, that stuff between the inner bark and the wood, and you get those touching, and then things take off. But never really have seen it as clearly presented. I feel pretty confident I could just take this book and go graft a few things, you know, and they would work. I mean,
all right, well,
very simple.
Let me give you some advice that's not mentioned in this chapter.
Gotcha.
You know what bleeding is, right?
Uh-huh.
Now, imagine cutting a huge gash into your thumb and blood pouring out.
Right.
Okay, that's grafting.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, you're cutting into a tree, true. Now, here, let me run this by you.
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
No, I'm talking literally. You're going to cut your thumb and it's going to bleed.
Oh, okay, I got you. I was wondering about that. I'm looking at this, all these very sharp tools making these very sharp cuts, and all I could think of is how I would probably end up cutting my hand if I wasn't careful.
So it's like you want to get some that tape that you use for bandaging yourself.
Right.
And put that on your thumb and get several layers on there, because you're going to be cutting into, and that's kind of how you do the grafting, is you cut into your thumb. Now, of course, once you get a lot of experience, you will cut into your thumb less, but with lots of experience comes lots of calluses on your thumb.
So it can take the cutting. I got it.
So all of my experience with grafting comes with bleeding. I've done a great deal of bleeding for the sake of grafting.
Well.
And pretty much I suck at it. However, there is a thing out there called the Omega tool, which I've seen before, and I hope maybe I'll go. I know that they've got it at the Bullock Brothers, and I know that Dave Bainline and I have talked about it at great length and whatnot. But basically, you put it into this tool, and it kind of clips out this special little shape that's an omega shape out of the rootstock, and then it'll cut a similar shape out of the scion wood, and then these two pieces fit together, and then you put a little bit of that rubber band around them, and you're done, and your thumb does not bleed. The last part being the most important part.
Right. Well,
and you've got a very good chance that the graft is going to take, much better chance than doing it the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, he was talking about things had to be cut in one cut. And I'm seeing myself out there with a samurai sword trying to chop that out, you know. I'm thinking, I don't know how that's going to happen. Really? Not a saw? I can't use a saw? Okay, all right.
Well, after you've done a couple hundred thousand, then you get much better at not cutting your thumb and having the graft actually take. Because that's another part of it, too, is that when you first start out, a lot of your grafts aren't going to take.
Ah, gotcha. Well, that makes sense.
And so then you start to move towards this space of, you know, getting to the point that 90% of your grafts will take. You know, I think that's what the experts hit, is about 90% actually take.
It's not
bad.
I
think if you start off, you might be good to get 20% of them to take.
So, gotcha. Well, you know, I love how he throws all these seeds out to see which rootstock comes up and does amazingly, and then he grafts specifically to that. You know, so it's the vigorous growing rootstocks is one of the points he tries to point out over and over in this, is that he wants vigorous growing rootstocks versus the dwarf or the slower growing rootstocks. And he's pointing out how they live longer and they do better and they hold things together and they're just better fruit. And so I'm all for that. But, you know, we'd had this kind of an idea. There's all these people all over our city that have fruit trees that are the ornamental fruit trees, and they're not designed to, you know, these particular ones don't put off any fruit. Now, if it's say, what was that one? It's like a pear tree, but it won't put off pears. But what would happen if you went and got a pear branch and grafted it on to this pear tree? Rather than dig up the pear tree and put in a pear tree that bears fruit, you could actually graft onto this ornamental and make, I mean, assuming that your graft would take, and then you would have a head start on getting pears. Does that make sense?
So I've got some theories that are a little bit different myself. And I also kind of feel a little bit, so I'm avoiding your question. I'm going to just dodge the question. And it's like, because now you're asking what I think, and it's kind of like, okay, where I think, I mean, and that's part of why I'm kind of like, yeah, this is, I'm not a big fan of this technique. A lot of the techniques that he's talked about in here with the grafting and stuff and his traditional way of doing it. And so I'm a bigger fan of, like, let's go out and start all of our apple trees, all of our fruit trees from seed, and they don't grow true to parent, but that's okay, because of, you know, if I've got 200 acres and I've done food forests all over the 200 acres, I probably have something on the order of 1,000 apple trees, and you know, spread out all over, you know, the property.
Sure.
And I'm going to probably be focused on only a couple hundred of those for apples that I want to keep. So we're talking about 20%. And so I'll have somehow marked off the best 20% for what's going to be the apple production stuff that I care about for my consumption and for probably resale or preservation or whatever. And the rest of them are for the wildlife, the pigs, the chickens, the cattle, etc. And so if I go and plant from seed, then roughly 20% of the seeds will grow up into trees that are excellent. So then that works out great. And then the remaining 80% are going to be either mediocre apples, or, you know, okay apples that are fine, or they're going to be spitters. They're going to be lousy, but then they're spitters to me, but not spitters to the other critters. So then I kind of feel like, so this whole system, everything is planted from seed. And planting a tree from seed is only about 1,000 times easier than, you know, doing something from seed in a pot, grafting scion wood onto it, and then taking the ones where they survive the process and then transplanting those. And now you've lost the taproot. Plus you have a graft in there, which kind of makes the tree suck a little bit. I mean, you get the upside of the genetics from that particular variety of wood and the predictability of that particular variety of tree, but you've given up a lot of health and vibrancy of the plant. So I've just traded one thing. So I've got this whole other way of doing things, this whole other approach.
Right, but I mean,
so when I'm reading this, I'm kind of like,
if you had rootstock that has, you know, that was grown from seed and it has a taproot, and you graft onto it, it would actually be less hardy, is what you're saying, because it's been grafted onto. I don't understand grafts that well, so I'm just checking.
It would be less vibrant, less healthy, less. It would be less a lot of things.
Okay.
And it's going to depend from tree to tree, from graft to graft. It's going to depend on what you grafted it to. And I've got some stuff marked off here, which I think is really important, because most people think that when they graft, then the thing that they want to do is graft on the dwarfing rootstock.
Right.
And so, Sep, I'm going to get a moment. In a moment, I'm going to read a part that Sep said that I think is really important. And when you read from the St. Lawrence Nurseries, it's very much the same as what Sep says, is like, do not screw around with the dwarf stuff or semi-dwarf or any of that. Go for the biggest, most vibrant, full-size stuff you can get, because that makes for the trees that can tolerate so much more, a much stronger, healthier tree. Full-size rootstock is the thing. So, did I answer your question, or am I still avoiding it?
No. It helps. I think, because I've listened to all your podcasts. And I know that your position is lots of property and food forest, and I'm coming from where I love that, and I'm working towards that. Right now I'm dealing with a lot of people who are in an urban setting, including myself, and they may already have a tree established, and what harm would it cause to give it a shot? At least they would have some fruit within the next year or two versus trying to wait for a tree, because there's nothing wrong with waiting for a tree, but it does take some time. And like I've spent 2 years, I haven't even gotten a lemon. I did get some buds this year. Now that I've been doing things a little bit more right, I've got a lot of green growth, new growth, buds. I'm very excited. So next year it looks good. But these came from a nursery. And I haven't been able to – this is another problem I'm having. I haven't been able to get a tree to start from seeds. I have a little juice company that I do, and I get a lot of lemon seeds, and I want to grow those lemons. I've never gotten one to sprout, but there is a little section in here where he talks about fermenting seeds, but we'll get into that in a minute, and I love that. I'm going to try it now.
Starting perennial seeds usually requires an extra step or two than just sticking them in the ground.
Right, obviously.
The annuals, you could just stick them into the ground and pop, they pop. But most seeds from perennials usually don't do anything until they make a trip through a bird or something else.
True.
And so they make a trip through a bird, trip through a ruminant. Sometimes they just, like apple seeds, just need to go through cold.
Right.
So it needs to get cold enough, and then the seed pops up, no problem.
Now, I do understand that. I'm, with citrus specifically, because it's kind of a warm weather thing, I'm not really sure what it needs. So I just tried a bunch of stuff and haven't gotten any results. But I do like what he's talking about here.
So I'm gonna read the first part that I've got marked off here. Cultivated fruit trees are not usually propagated using seeds because the characteristics of the desired variety will not be passed on true through the seeds. This quality has been encouraged to the extent that many fruit cultivars can now only be pollinated by different varieties. This means that every flower, and therefore every fruit, can produce different seeds and consequently different characteristics. So if you want to preserve the qualities of a certain variety, you must propagate it vegetatively. And by that he means grafting and,
right,
and cloning and things of that nature. And then later he goes on to talk about rootstock. For my method of grafting, however, I prefer rootstocks from vigorous growing seedlings from fruit grown from seeds and wild varieties. Dwarf varieties used as rootstocks do not grow as vigorously. They do not develop strong root systems, which is one of the most important conditions for an independent tree. The weak roots mean that the trees frequently have to be tied to stakes so that they will not be knocked over by the wind or snow. They also cannot supply themselves as well with nutrients, which means that they have to rely on good soil or even fertilizer. They are more sensitive to drought, and they are usually much more susceptible to disease and frost. So I know that, like with St. Lawrence Nurseries, all of their rootstock is, I'm not sure if it's from seed. I think it is from seed. Because there's this variety of tree from Russia called, and I've seen it written like four or five different ways, but I think it's like Anakatovna or Anakanovita or something like that. And my understanding is that the seeds from this variety are almost always true to parent, which is weird,
okay,
unusual, very, you know, rare. And on top of that, the tree is crazy vigorous. You know, it's just amazingly huge and bushy and fast growing and superhero-esque.
And this is not an apple or anything. It's a specific kind of fruit.
No, it's an apple.
Oh, it is an
apple.
This is
a variety. This is a variety of apple.
So is it possible this is one of those natural selection varieties that was never hybridized or whatever? I mean, like, they literally just picked the one apple and kept moving it forward. I don't know if that works that way. I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah. You know.
but here is what I do know, is that this is – so usually what you'll do is like, okay, you're running an apple tree business. You're going to sell apple trees. So what you'll do is you'll get a big sack of these seeds, or maybe you'll grow one of these trees yourself, then you'll save the seeds yourself, and then when the time comes, you're going to go stick these seeds in little pots, and that's your rootstock.
Gotcha.
And it does so well, and then you'll graft onto that. So I think at St. Lawrence Nursery, that's what they do, is they save all the seeds from this particular variety of tree, put them all into pots, they get started, and then they graft onto that rootstock. And that's their, because it is like the most popular rootstock for full-sized apple trees.
Right, because it does so well. And whatever you put on there just benefits from its vigorous growth and all the greatness of it.
And I also have heard that in Russia, it's like the most popular apple juice. Like, there's apple juice, and then there's this variety of apple juice, which is like people's favorite variety for apple juice.
Oh, so in other words, the fruit that comes off this thing is really good fruit.
Well, good for juice at least.
Oh, okay, yeah, gotcha.
You know, and I know very little about it from there, but I do think that, you know, it would be good to get. Now I have planted at my old farm. I planted some trees that were non-grafted. And this variety of tree, and I think I probably got them from St. Lawrence Nursery, because I really enjoy that source for a lot of stuff. And I bought, I think I probably dropped several grand with those guys, planting stuff to my farm.
And they'll mail their stuff around, right? They're not just a local place.
They are a mail order place.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Right. Right. And
apple trees probably aren't going to do well down here. We're rarely getting any kind of freeze. So, yeah, I do know that they take some cold weather to bud out sometimes or something. But, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is not going to work for you. Because I think that these guys, St. Lawrence Nurseries, I'm pretty sure that they're in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they might be in zone 3. Like,
wow.
Really cold.
6 feet of snow. Okay, gotcha.
Well, hey, actually, you know what? Snow, if you live in an area that has a lot of snow, usually that's not all that cold.
No, all the humidity's on the ground. It's sucked all the moisture out of it.
When you get down to, like, it's like snow happens, I'm going to make some guesses here, if I remember just from vague memories, it happens from about 10 or 15 degrees up through, you know, a little over freezing, like 32, 35 degrees. So that's where snow happens. But you get colder than 10 or 15 degrees, it's too cold to snow. It won't snow.
Ah.
Yeah, and so then a lot of people are like saying, you know, global warming must be a lie because look at all the snow. And it's like, oh, man, you so don't get this too cold to snow thing. So basically, in years past, like 100 years ago, you might have had a lot of weather where it was too cold to snow, and so then you got less snow. Now that it's a little bit warmer, you can get more snow.
Ah.
And that's why you're seeing more snow in the wintertime.
I remember being in a car. We got to a place where it was snowing. We got out, and we were still in our T-shirts because we were from Florida, you know. And it didn't seem that cold. It was like, wow, I expected it to be a whole lot colder. In Florida, when it gets cold, because we have a very humid climate, it kind of does sort of like soak into the bones. It's like you're feeling you're wet and cold at the same time. So that's crappy. But I did like how dry and in the snow it was, and noticed how comfortable it was. But I guess it could snow and still be much colder. So,
that's true too. Yeah. That's true too. I remember one time working. It was my first day of work in a contract in San Diego, and then it got to be lunchtime, and it's January, and it's 70 degrees outside, which, like, in San Diego, and we're, like, right next to the ocean where I was working, and so it's, like, pretty much 70 degrees in the winter and, like, I don't know, 75 in the summer.
Right.
And so basically, so it's 70 degrees outside, and then everybody's like, hey, let's all go out to lunch, and then everybody's putting on their coats.
Yeah.
And it's like, really? You guys are putting on your coats to go outside, and it's 70 degrees?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
we get that a lot here, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So when you said, oh, we all got outside, it was snowing, we all got outside, and we're from Florida, and we weren't wearing our coats. And I kind of thought, so when you say, when you're, like, you're explaining that, as we're getting, like, because people from Florida are stupid? Is that what it is?
Just not like, used to
no,
it.
I
see people going down the street with, skull caps on and 2-3 layers, and it's really just, like, hitting 65, and I'm thinking, for real, guys, you know? I mean,
yeah.
Okay, well, you know, if it gets windy, it's cold, you know, but... that's a good one. But before we moved on, I wanted to mention something about one of the benefits that I see to, and I know you're not a big fan of grafting, but like if I'm in this little postage stamp yard, and if you need a fruit tree variety where you have to have two trees, he does mention having multiple pollinating varieties on one tree using grafting and have it pollinate itself. And I thought that was fantastic.
Well, yes, and so then that's kind of like the famous thing that you can do in an apple tree, the 5-on-1 apple tree, where you've basically gone around the apple tree and you've grafted on 5 different kinds of scion wood onto the tree.
Right.
So that's something you could do. Another thing that, I mean, I know that they, at the Bullock Brothers, something that they do a lot of is they'll go and they'll take varieties that they like and splice it on to... Like they'll say, okay, we got 30 pieces of scion wood from this variety we really like, and then they'll go around and they'll splice it on 30 different trees as like, so then you'll get like this one branch maybe that's got this whole other variety. They really enjoy doing that.
Right.
Having the 5-on-1 thing. Another thing I know that they do over at the Bullock Brothers, which I think is really kind of cool, is they have a lot of deer, and so what they do is that they will graft pear onto hawthorn.
Oh, wow.
And so, but they'll graft it on high up. So then you'll get like all this hawthorn stuff with the thorn part of the hawthorn low.
Right.
And then the pear part high up. And then the deer kind of like don't want to mess with the thorn, so they let it go.
Now, I think Toby Hemingway talks about that in his book, right? Where he's got one side is a variety for... sometimes one side is a variety that the deer like, and the other side is a variety that we like, and we've got a hedge of this. Or he was talking about hawthorn as well, where you've got the, you know, the pokey, thorny part, and it protects the fruit we want from the grazers. So, yeah, I mean, I've read that one before, too, and I can't wait to try it. But, I mean, is this something that you would not like to do?
Boy, my answer to that is really, I mean, I've got a whole bunch of things to say to that. One of them is that I know that Toby's responses more recently have been a lot richer. I'm pretty sure I made a podcast about keeping deer off of your stuff with Toby. Toby basically, it's like these kinds of things are things that have a fair bit of effectiveness in areas of low deer pressure. So the deer are able to find lots of other food, you know, outside of these trees, and coming and nibbling on your stuff is something to pass the time kind of a thing. And then it's like you put a little thorns in their way, and it's like, yeah, okay, I'm not going to bother.
Gotcha.
But if it's like the line between life and death, and the deer is like, I got to get past the thorns to get to the food or I'm going to die, and then the thorns don't work so good.
Right.
And then he's talked about, you know, so deer pressure is part of this. And then, you know, the whole thing with my food on this side and deer food on the other side, that kind of comes to deer pressure too, especially if, you know, you hang out in your garden often enough that the deer really don't want the stuff in your garden because they got plenty of stuff on the outside of your garden.
Right.
But, and I think, you know, Sepp talks about that, Toby talks about that, and it's a big, rich area. If you've got some stuff for the deer, I think that's one of the best reasons in the world to plant mulberry trees, not for deer, but for birds. If birds are coming and wiping out your crop, and you got lots of mulberry trees, well, they're just crazy about those mulberries before they want to eat anything else.
So am I. Mulberries are so good. I don't know about the varieties up in Missoula, but the ones down here are like eating candy. It's insane.
So I'm not a big mulberry fan. I mean, I've tried a variety of different mulberries, and they kind of have this weird kind of stinky flavor. And either they have no flavor at all, in which case they're just like liquid sugar, or they have this kind of stinky thing going on that I don't seem to like. And sometimes I can eat a few mulberries and be like, oh, okay, that was all right. But it's like, If you've got some good raspberries right next to them, it's like, oh, no, I want the raspberry.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say that because here we can – I believe we can grow raspberries. But when we eat the mulberries, it seems as if they're raspberry-ish, but they're so much sweeter. And I don't think there's a stinky flavor to them at all. I mean, everybody just grabs them and eats them up like they're candy. I'll have to FedEx overnight some mulberries to you. See if I'm just full of it, or if this is what you're talking about, you know.
Right. In the book, I read through all of the stuff about the different types of grafting and the scion wood. He's got a section on scion wood, cleft grafting, whip and tongue grafting, bud grafting, bridge grafting. He's got all that. And then I've kind of skipped over all that because I've got some stuff that I think is far more important. But now, in visiting with you before we started recording, it sounded like the grafting was something that that you were really keen on.
Well, I have never done it before, and it's probably going to be further down the line because for me, I've got to get a bunch of things established before I can even start thinking about grafting. I'm not going to mess with it, but to read this section, it really makes you jump out of your chair and go, man, I got to go try grafting something. This is amazing. I just want to see, you know, does this work? Can I get this to work? And can I have two or three different varieties on one tree that will, because I've got a pear tree, or no, a plum tree. And I do believe, correct me if I'm wrong, plum trees are going to require more than one plum tree in order to create fruit. And if that's the case, maybe I can graft.
I think that most fruit trees, are going to require a tree of a slightly different variety in order to be able to do the birds and the bees thing.
Right.
You know, in order to have fruit. And but it's like, you know what? I cannot remember all I can't remember, like, even if it applies to apples. I can't remember. All I remember thinking was, is like, so if you're in an urban area, you really don't have to worry about it because so many other fruit trees are going to be of the same species in your area that it doesn't really matter, you know. I do know that when it comes to, my vocabulary just left me. the fruit with the fuzz, kiwi. When
kiwi.
It comes to kiwi, that it's very common that you'll buy four or five females and one male.
Right.
Because otherwise it ends up not working out. I'm not sure whether the bees don't go as far, or probably because it's like less chance of, like, if you're in an urban environment that other people are going to have the male kiwis, and so you're going to provide your own male. I know that it's an issue with stuff that's more rural. Like, if you're going to grow a variety of different fruit trees, you need to make sure to have enough variety so that they'll pollinate each other and stuff like that. But in an urban environment, you usually don't have to worry about it.
Well, you know,
bees will go such a long, long way.
In Florida, anyway, if you drive down my road, you're going to find pine trees and live oaks, laurel oaks, water oaks, oak trees. You're going to find sweet gum. Nobody has anything fruiting. And so this is why, I mean, you're pretty much, you know, you have a fruit tree, you're an island. So I've got to think about that. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is another plum tree within 2 miles, 3 miles, or however far a bee will go. But I haven't seen it. Yeah, there's a pear tree about 5 miles from here. It's exciting. I'm like, oh, a pear tree. Oh, and the pears that come off that thing are amazing.
Okay.
Yeah. So our group, we're running around trying to put gardens and fruiting trees into everybody's yard that will accept them. And so these are the things I have to think about. How do I get something to, you know, basically live on its own until we can get more stuff going? And this is why the whole idea of, you know, taking an ornamental and grafting something that will bear fruit on it, maybe even two or three varieties, boy, that's compelling. I love the idea.
I would rather, I mean, for an urban thing, okay, I can kind of see that.
Right.
I can kind of see that would be, because you have, oh, I have one fruit tree, and I'll have, because I...
This podcast will be continued in part 2. If you like this sort of thing, come out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about Sepp Holzer, homesteading, and permaculture all the time.